Hello and welcome to the Rest is History's latest bonus episode. So Tom, last week we put out two episodes on Captain Cook. This week our listeners should be finished or be in the middle of the little series on young Napoleon. And next week we begin our epic sweep through the fall of the Aztecs. And of course we're gearing up for our Hammersmith show as well, aren't we?
Well, by the time that the listeners get this, we'll have done it. So the spectacular failure of the show will be plastered all over
the national newspapers.
National humiliation.
Shaming. Shaming. All right, Tom, we have to go on BBC Radio Ulster, don't we?
In literally 25 minutes.
So we're going to have to whistle through these questions.
Well,
so let's do it slightly quickfire-ish, because there's a brilliant one to start with. It's from Black Clitus. Some people think he died in Afghanistan, but clearly, or whenever it was, but clearly not, because he's alive and asking us questions. Who do you sympathize with, Tom, in the Roman Civil Wars? I know it's not a historian's job to sympathize, but everyone does really, one way or the other. So Sulla or Marius, Caesar or Pompey, Octavian or Brutus? Black Clitus says he finds it hard to decide who he would have supported. Who are your sympathies with, really, in those conflicts?
Sulla, Caesar,
Sulla,
Augustus.
Why do you support Sulla?
I just like his kind of seedy metrosexual vibe.
Right. And because he's the representative of the kind of patrician elite, isn't he?
Yeah. I so obviously identify with that.
But Marius, is he not the bluff working man?
Yeah, he is.
Is that not Marius's thing?
Yeah.
Who would I support, Marius or Sulla? I can never decide.
Would you be Marius?
I read Colleen McCulloch's...
Whose side is she on?
Well, I thought Sulla was very cool.
Before we go ahead, I just want to put it on the record. They're all horrible.
Yeah, but they're not, though, are they? I don't think they are. See, David Mitchell said this about medieval kings. He said, they're all terrible people.
And no, but medieval kings, by our standards, are not. We share the same cultural moral frameworks as them.
Right.
But the Romans are very different. Yeah, exactly. Theo said Christianity and the thing. Of course.
I don't think they are necessarily horrible. I think they're just in a world where they have to behave horribly to not be killed.
You don't have to. You don't have to march with your legions on Rome.
Caesar wasn't a horrible man, surely.
Well, apart from when he was...
Okay, he killed a lot of Gauls.
Yeah.
But I mean, who?
In aid of his career.
Some people would say that's perfectly reasonable.
Well, you would. I mean, lots of people did think that was entirely reasonable. I mean, that was those were the frames of reference.
For example, Caesar in his personal relations, he treated his opponents with great clemency, didn't he? I know they found it humiliating.
Okay.
But he's not vengeful in that way.
So what I would say, support Sulla over Marius, because I think Sulla is a more creative political leader. Marius is a much less sophisticated figure. So that's why I'd probably go with Sulla.
Yeah.
Accepting that Sulla is a horrible, horrible man who disposes of large quantities of the aristocracy. Caesar, I think, is... Well, Caesar's a winner. I mean, Caesar is Caesar. He's one of the most remarkable men of all time.
Caesar's a winner, you were about to say, which is the ultimate historical glory hunter, Tom Holland.
Caesar was a remarkable man in every way. It's almost possible to be remarkable. And Augustus is one of the great...
politicians, isn't he?
The supreme political figure in Western history.
Okay.
So basically, I go with the winners, which is a very Roman attitude.
What about Octavian and Antony? And Antony and Cleopatra. Do you not feel a bit sorry for Cleopatra?
No, I always secretly side with Octavian.
Do you?
Chill, uncharismatic.
I think you're very harsh on Octavian, actually, in Rubicon. I think I've always liked Octavian. I admire him.
Good. Well, so do I.
I like people who are really good at things. And he's very, very good at politics.
Well, Antony's very good at getting off with Egyptian queens.
With women. Yeah.
So,
okay, fair
enough. Depends what your standards yes. are, Dominic. Okay, Tony Bang, who is considered the greatest warrior of all time?
I think the two that people point to, that they invoke when they know nothing of history, so they're just invoking a great warrior in conversation, the two are probably, first of all, Genghis Khan.
Yeah.
I mean, he's somebody that everybody has heard of, even if they have absolutely no, even if they think he fought in the Second World War, the name. And secondly, I suppose Alexander is the inspirational one, isn't he? He is the one who was, I mean, you've mentioned Pompey already and Caesar. So to both of those men, Alexander was an inspiration. The idea of somebody who, in inverted commas, conquered the world, of course he didn't. Is there somebody who I'm missing?
I would say those are the two obvious ones.
Yeah.
And they never lose, do they?
General Peter de la Billière or Norman Schwarzkopf or some modern, very modern figure. General David Petraeus.
Okay.
Anyway,
here's one from Reticus.
Yes.
Who had more impact on American history, JFK or Nixon, and why?
That is a hard one to
I suppose JFK didn't incinerate the world in a war.
Yes.
So you'd say that's a pretty big deal.
I mean, to be fair, Nixon didn't incinerate the world in a war either.
We've just recorded an episode on the Peasants' Revolt, haven't we? In which we've got a lot of cliches. And I suppose Nixon wasn't staring down the barrel of prospective nuclear holocaust in quite the way that...
No, he wasn't staring the mushroom cloud in the face, was he?
No.
I would say Nixon.
Just in political terms, rather than sparing the world nuclear destruction.
Yeah, so your argument about JFK would be to say JFK, with his sort of Camelot romance and stuff, he became the subject of this myth of the fallen leader and of lost innocence, which is very important in American history. That undoubtedly matters. On the other hand, with Nixon, I think you have two things. One is Nixon is a key figure in the development of a kind of conservative populist politics. He's not the only figure, of course, Reagan as well, Goldwater, or later on, Mr. Trump. But Nixon is one of the great, I mean, you talked about creative politicians. Nixon is a very clever and creative politician, the way he puts together a new kind of Republican majority at the end of the 1960s. So that's really, really important. But of course, the second thing is that because of Watergate, Nixon has this huge afterlife in American politics, a distrust of government, the idea the president is lying to you, the idea of shadowy conspiracy at the heart of Washington. That's always been there in American history, but Nixon completely turbocharges that. And you take him out of the equation, you could argue that American democracy might look quite different in the 1970s and 80s.
Yeah.
It might well not have done, but I think his afterlife is in that sense more significant than Kennedy's, even though Kennedy's is more eye-catching and glamorous.
Though you could say, and I know you have said it because we've just done a whole series of episodes on it,
yeah,
that JFK's assassination, because he gets killed and the conspiracies that surround him, that this also has a seismic impact on American political culture.
It does. The interesting thing is that they're so close together in time. And of course, these are the two candidates from 1960.
And they got on well, didn't they, basically?
They did get on pretty well. Yeah, we have that story about them, don't we, in the series about them on the train having a chat. I think the two things are now very closely intertwined in the public memory. So the idea of the shining promise of the Kennedy administration, and then it curdles into the darkness of Nixon and Watergate. That's a staple of so many documentaries and the sort of, you know, fiction writers' images of the 1960s.
It exemplifies how the kind of the tunneling effect that the passage of time has.
Yeah.
That Kennedy and Nixon, if you were in the 60s, I mean, their presidencies would have seemed very different periods, very different type. But now you look back and they start to blur. You know, in 200 years' time.
I always find that so fascinating. I love to think about that because, of course, what I do, well, I mean, you've done it yourself in Rubicon or PAX, is, you know, I write enormous books about incredibly small periods of history. And often one of the things that I find most fun is to think, how was 1976 different from 1978?
Yeah.
You know, because they are different. There's often a different mood. And then you think, yeah, but I mean, come on, this is ridiculous. Because, you know, you'll read a book about the Victorians that treats the Victorians as all one thing.
Yeah.
You know, even though it's from the 1830s to the 1900s.
The Victorian cast of mind.
Right, exactly. The idea that you could even talk of a Victorian sensibility, talking about somebody from the 1830s and somebody from the 1900s, just seems bonkers. But as you say, the Kennedy and Nixon presidencies seem to belong to totally different eras, the 60s and the 70s. But to our successors, these will seem just part of the interchangeable kind of facets of a particular moment.
I think the 60s and 70s are already starting to blur in the way that people think about them.
Yeah, I think so too. I think so too. What do they mean to somebody who is 15 now? The 60s and 70s, yeah, and the cultural differences and political differences between them. Those differences must be completely meaningless. Anyway.
Right.
Do you want one?
Yeah, as long as it's not about the Cagots.
Alexander Cardill has asked the most difficult question. What is your consensus on why the Cagots were persecuted?
So imagine you're sitting down for a history exam and you've swatted up on everything. And that's the question you get given. Neither of us know who the Cagots are.
I think they might be the Cagots.
The Cagots.
They're French.
Are they French?
Aren't they?
Okay.
Yeah. They're from southwestern France, I believe.
I was wondering if maybe they were the Cabots and they were persecuted for discovering Newfoundland.
Newfoundland. Well, we've got a mighty. I mean, we've been persecuted for talking about Newfoundland, Tom, and pronouncing it wrongly.
I met a Canadian yesterday who scolded me.
How do they pronounce it?
You've got to understand Newfoundland is how you remember it.
Newfoundland.
Newfoundland. Understand Newfoundland.
Oh, right. So we're doing it totally wrong.
Yeah. So it's Newfoundland.
Are you sure? That doesn't sound right to me.
Well, that's what I was told yesterday.
Okay.
So I promise we'd do better.
Well, I'm surprised. I mean, actually, now that you've brought that up, you have two extraordinary accents in this week's Napoleon episodes, don't you?
I don't think they're extraordinary. I mean, extraordinary to the degree that it exemplifies the paradox at the heart of France's greatest leader, Napoleon Bonaparte.
Right.
That all the way through, he had a Ligurian accent.
Yeah.
And I thought the way that I brought to life the Ligurian quality in the first episode... And then even though it's not, strictly speaking, historically accurate to give him a French accent, there are times where distortions of the historical record illustrate a profounder historical truth, I think.
Yeah, symbolic truth, Tom. It's deep. I think you got to the metaphysical essence of Napoleon with those accents.
Well, that's what we sometimes like to do on the podcast, isn't it?
The rest is history.
Recognize that the metaphysical essence can somehow... sometimes have a relevance greater than mere pettifogging facts. And I was happy to do that because I had illustrated to the listeners that I did have a mastery of the Ligurian accent first. So I thought that was fine. Anyway, this is by the by. What did you want to ask?
I wanted to ask Helen McStravick's question. So we haven't had Helen McStravick before on this podcast. I think it was time we did. She's an adult, she says, on the second year of her Open University history degree. I assume it's Open University. She's written OU. And I think that's Open University. Something that keeps coming back to me is this. Everybody, says God is on our side, Tom. And she says, it's a good question, actually. What happens when you lose?
Yeah.
So do you say, well, God wasn't on our side? Do you say the other side were right? Do you lose your faith? Now, actually, the thing about losing your faith takes us back to, I think it must have been in Baghdad or something, the sense of, what happens to people in the Levant, for example, when you have the Islamic conquests? How quickly do they put aside their Christianity and embrace the faith of the winners? And I guess that's implied by Helen's question, isn't it? How quickly do people say, well, we thought God was on our side, but these fellows have wiped the floor with us. Their God must be stronger. Their faith must be more authentic, must be purer or whatever. We should embrace their faith. How quickly do you think that generally happens?
I think it depends on how deeply held a faith is and even whether... the beliefs that you have kind of qualify as a faith. I think there are so many different ways that you can have a relationship with the sense of the supernatural that probably the way we would think of it would be Islam and Christianity, that these are the two great rival faiths that have contested the Mediterranean and so on. And I mean, and there's no question that in the wake of the capture of Constantinople, lots of Greek Christians became Muslim.
Yeah.
And conversely, in the wake of the Reconquista in Spain, lots of Muslims and Jews became Christian. The one that I always, it's very timely at the moment, but it's kind of upsetting in some ways to think about, is what happens to Judeans in the wake, first of the destruction of the temple, and then of Hadrian's essentially obliteration of Judea and its reconstitution as Palestine. And the assumption is that the collapse of the presence of Judeans in Judea in that period is due to casualties in war or enslavement or whatever. I mean, that's clearly a part of it. But I would say overwhelmingly more, it's people losing their faith. It's Judeans feeling that their God has failed them.
But how much is it people who feel that they have failed their God? I mean, that's very common, isn't it? That you feel like we lost because we weren't. And it's not because Christianity was wrong, let's say. It's because we weren't Christian enough and we've been punished for our sins.
Yeah, that's the way you steel yourself. And obviously, if you have, a religious identity that is proof against that, then that's very, that enables you to stick to it. That's what both Christians and Muslims had throughout the period where they were ideological rivals.
Okay.
Do you want another question?
Sure. Do you want to ask me one?
Barley de Berry, if we went on a history holiday together, I assume, Laurel and Hardy style, where in the world would you go to keep you both interested and who gets bored first? I think we know that, don't we? Because we've discussed it before. I think we go to Turkey.
Yeah, I think Turkey would be a great place to go.
Because there'd be something for all of us there.
Yeah. So even something for Theo, actually.
What would Theo get?
Lots of opportunities to record bonus episodes. Which is all he seems to be interested in. Or ad reads.
But he can do that anywhere. We could go to Milton Keynes.
Yeah, because actually he would complain about the noise in Turkey, knowing Theo. He'd say, oh, it's very noisy here, the sound of the bazaar or something. It's not good for the sound.
I mean, obviously, going to New Zealand and Australia, it's not a holiday, is it, Dominic?
It's absolutely not a holiday.
Certainly, if our wives are listening to this, it's not a holiday. I mean, we're going to be working very hard. But Theo will be coming along and doing bonus episodes on that.
Yeah, Theo's not going on holiday at all.
Oh, no.
I would go, Turkey, Rome, Egypt, because I think we probably enjoy similar things on holidays. Although you like walks in the rain by Hadrian's Wall, which I would not appreciate.
I do like walking. I probably like walking more than you do.
I like going for walks on holidays. I don't like going for unnecessary and unscenic walks.
Through car parks.
So I like a lot of nature.
When wearing dress shoes.
Correct. Absolutely correct.
But I would say Turkey.
Okay. Zep B has asked a question which anticipates our Aztec series, which is coming soon. He says, what happened to the Mayans? My understanding is the entire civilization just disappeared. So what happened? Are you big on the Mayans, Tom?
No, not particularly. I mean, I know that they were founded by extraterrestrials, but apart from that, I don't really know. And the people from Atlantis built their pyramids, but aside from that...
So the sort of claim is that the Mayan civilization, which is this absolutely extraordinary civilization in the the 6th century or something, 5th century, 4th century, where they had all kinds of interesting astronomical clocks or whatever they had.
Astronomical clocks.
I don't know, whatever they had. and chocolate. In the 8th century...
And ball games.
Ball games. The ball game is the big thing, obviously, in these sort of walled courts. And they had their temples and pyramid temples and things. You know, the sort of Channel 5 or Netflix sort of documentary spin is that Mayan civilization underwent this extraordinary collapse in the 8th century, and that this is a terrible warning of hubris, you know, and modernity will come crashing down like the Mayan collapse.
Because they have a calendar, don't they? Cyclical calendar. And it was going to happen again in 2012.
Exactly. And historians have tried to make sense of this because they've noticed that the cities become less populated, that the technology appears to go backwards, that people seem to get to a point where it's as though they're not understanding some of their own script or their own symbols and things. And it's a little bit like the story of the collapse of the Roman Empire, actually, that historians have come up with lots of rival explanations. So drought is a very common one, over-farming, an epidemic, environmental damage. So actually, as you can probably tell from the things that I'm listing, people tend to point to whatever anxiety is uppermost in their own minds about the present moment to say, that happened to the Mayans.
Climate change,
exactly. And now I think a lot of historians say it didn't actually collapse. It evolved. And
that's very, very fall of the Roman Empire.
It's very fall of the Roman Empire, exactly. That the Roman Empire didn't fall. It just evolved into, and that there's no point where people think, the Roman Empire has fallen now.
So with the fall of the Roman Empire or the evolution, whatever, I mean, that's clearly, there's a very political dimension to that, which isn't to say it's wrong, but it clearly reflects a certain anxiety about the notion that the replacement of one political order with another, driven by perhaps immigration, that there's a big anxiety about that. Is there a kind of matching dynamic going on with analysis of the Mayans?
There's not a barbarian invasion element to it. With the Mayans. So, I mean, because that element is obviously the really controversial one among historians. So the historians we've talked about it many times, the sort of Guy Housall tendency, gnash their teeth and rend their garments when somebody talks about barbarian invasions, because they see that as kind of anti-immigrant, as potentially xenophobic.
Yeah.
It's more internal, the Mayan thing. But I think historians are now they're so anxious and sensitive about ideas of civilization and
some things being better than others.
Yeah, being better than others. So they say, well, it's not worse, it's just different.
Yeah.
I would say personally, I mean, contra what Karl Harper said about disease, living in cities is may well be more prone to disease, but it is better than scratching out a subsistence existence in the rainforest, personally. So I think the Mayans did decay and did decline. But historians ultimately just don't really know. It may be a combination of a lot of these factors. And I guess we never will know, maybe.
Until that great depository of records buried under one of the pyramids is found.
Yeah, or maybe some new, it could well be an epidemic. Could be a combination of an epidemic. And it's a bit like the work that's been done on this, the Roman world in the 6th century, right? Where people now think combination of plague and climate change. But again, there are two current concerns, aren't they? Will people think of that in 50 years or 100 years? Who knows?
Well, Dominic, so we don't really know what happened to the Mayans. So that's good. And it's just as well that we haven't done an 8-part series on them then. But we do know what happens to the Aztecs, pretty much.
We do. Nothing good.
No, nothing good. And so that is going to be the theme of the next monster series, our first eight-parter, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
Cortez, Moctezuma.
It's sort of blow by blow, isn't it?
Yeah. Malinche. There's that to look forward to. You've got the Napoleons. After the Aztecs, we have JFK, who we've talked about on this episode. Again, that's great. I love that. I really love that.
That's fun to do, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It's fun to do.
And then we're into the festive period.
We are.
I can't remember what we're doing for that, but lots to look forward to.
So we have to go and do interviews with Northern Ireland Radio right now. So for those of you who are feeling shortchanged by the slight brevity of the bonus, there are two consolations. Because last week saw the publication, Tom, of not one but two books associated with The Rest Is History. Because we had the publication of The Fall of the Aztecs, The Latest Adventure in Time.
Thrilling. But don't read that before listening to the episodes, because it will give the game away.
Okay. Buy it.
Yeah, definitely buy it.
But don't read it.
And I think when you listen to those episodes, you'll enjoy them so much that you'll want to read the book of the podcast.
That is kind.
I think it's your best one, Dominic.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
And they're all brilliant, but I think this is really good. And the reason it's so good is that it's such a sensitive topic. And in a sense, as we discuss in the episode, there's a certain kind of political sensitivity around the very idea of the narrative being exciting, isn't there?
Yeah.
And you negotiate all these shoals with great aplomb.
Oh, thank you. That's all those years of writing for Associated Newspapers. Give you a real sense of balance and sensitivity. Now, talking of balance and sensitivity, what could be more balanced and sensitive than our own Super Sore Away Rest Is History book, Tom?
Yes.
Which came out last week.
Which is also available as an audiobook. And if you get the audiobook, you get us doing accents.
Yeah. We did them separately though, didn't we? Because we did do one day of recording together and then we did the rest kind of in bubbles.
Quite excited to hear it. I want to see how you've done.
And the producers kept saying to me, oh, Tom did an amazing accent for this bit. You have to match it.
Yeah, great.
And they actually played me one of, because I was reluctant to do Richard Nixon, to do a whole chapter in the voice of Richard Nixon. They said, we'll play you a bit of one of Tom's chapters. And when they'd done that, I was like, fine, I'll do it. You know,
yeah,
I'm in.
He's humiliated himself. I might as well join in.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not going to be worse than that.
No. So.
Right. Let's go and talk to Belfast. For the rest of you, thank you, as always, for all your support. We will be back next week with whatever... The Fall of the Aztecs, of course. The Fall of the Aztecs.
Fall of the Aztecs. And also, we'll be heading off to New Zealand. So maybe see you in Hobbiton.
Very good. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.